Both parties celebrate municipal election wins. State Treasurer Daniel Elliott bets big on Israel, plus Jennifer McCormick's consulting gig, and more. From the television studios at WFYI, it's Indiana Week in Review for the week ending November 10th, 2023.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.
This week, both the Indiana Democratic and Republican parties had reasons to celebrate Tuesday's election results. Democrats flipped mayoral seats in Evansville, Terre Haute, and Lawrence, among others, while Republicans continued to strengthen their advantage in rural Indiana and regain some ground in Hamilton County, the northern suburbs of Indianapolis. Political scientist Andrew Downs says, in a broad sense, it was a kind of status quo election.
Both can say, yeah, we had a good night. We're proud of ourselves. And really, in many respects, they will have to acknowledge they could have had better nights.
Downs says it's hard to predict much about 2024 from 2023's results, since this year's races are so much more locally focused.
Potholes are not dealt with at the state level. Picking up leaves and removing snow, those aren't dealt with at the state level.
Downs did say that both parties can focus on areas where they scored key victories and look to build from those bases of support for next year. Could both parties claim major victories in this week's elections? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat, Ann Delaney. Republican, Mike O'Brien. John Schwanis, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, editor-in-chief of the Indiana Capital Chronicle. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House Bureau Chief Brandon Smith. Mike O'Brien, would you call this Tuesday a split decision?
Yeah, I think both sides can look at a bright spot, you know, or generally how they did well. I think the way it was characterized and kind of the lead-in, that the rural areas, Republicans flipped 14 mayor's races. We have 76 statewide, but there are a lot of cities we haven't represented in decades, that Republicans haven't won in decades. But we gave back to large cities, yeah. Evansville and Terre Haute, that we, arguably should have maybe had to begin with. We kind of caught those back in Tea Party kind of surge years, right, when all that was going. And there was a good young candidate, the Democrat in Terre Haute, really worked. And
yeah, rising star.
Going for a fifth term, sometimes there's a little fatigue. So, there's reasons to explain that. I think generally what you're seeing is outstate is getting redder and the urban centers are getting bluer. We definitely proved by setting a pile of money on fire in Marion County that maybe a Republican mayor is a little out of reach.
Reasons for both sides to be happy?
Well, I think for the Hoosiers who are represented by municipalities that had elections this year, the vast majority of the population is now in democratically controlled cities. And it's very encouraging. And I think the Republican brand took a hit. I think where Democrats put the election deniers and Todd Rokita and Diego up there, it hurt them. Because voters understand that they're anti-choice and they're pro-gun and all of those kinds of things. We have a lot to celebrate. Deb Whitfield did a great job in Lawrence, and our new mayor in Evansville as well, two African-American women. But the other thing I think that needs a shout-out in this is the Hoosier Women Forward. They put 18 candidates forward, and 12 of them won. 12 of them won.
This is also the first time we had graduates from the Republican Diversity leadership group. It's been a really successful program.
We saw major diversity progress in both parties. Mm-hmm. You had the first black Republican mayor elected in Marion this week. Obviously, you just talked about Stephanie Terry, Deb Whitfield in those two cities. Looking, though, at you talked about the bluer, the cities getting right. bluer, the outer areas right. getting redder. But the purple areas, the areas we think might be purple, which is the suburbs of Indianapolis, didn't quite go as purple as we thought.
No, I think for the last three or four election cycles, everyone keeps saying, we're going to see it this time. We're going to see it this time. Hamilton and some of the suburbs are.
And Democrats did make progress, historic progress in 2019,
right.
but lost some of that ground this year.
Mm-hmm. But we're just not seeing a wholesale change. I mean, we're talking about a seat here or there every other cycle. So I don't know. I think maybe we've gotten a little too into, are these demographics changing and when we're going to see a big shift?
Yeah.
And
I think when you see the national play in and when you see the issue of choice front and center, which it will be in 2024, I think you're going to see
Actually right. I think we're conflating Republican moderate Republicans in those suburbs with not liking Donald Trump with becoming Democrats. And I don't think that's true. I think it's reactive. So that's why you have a Sue Finkham who wins Carmel mayor race by 15 points.
And I think, so in terms of, it's so hard to predict anything for next year based on this year's results because a municipal election does not equal a statewide election or even a state house election at all because the issues are so radically different. The electorate is very different, too. You just talked about it. It's largely moderate Republicans winning in these seats in Hamilton County and that sort of thing that Democrats lost ground on. But will it so much depend on some of those suburban House districts next year? Will so much depend on who the Republican candidates are?
I think so. And we've seen time and again, suburban women are deciding elections across this country and across this state, certainly. That's nothing new. So, and everything that's been said here is to a degree right. I mean, both sides claim victory, but show me an election where both sides don't claim to have benefited in some fashion. In fact, even
in the 2016 election in this state, I don't think Democrats had much to crow
about. But look, if you look at, you know, Ohio, Virginia, Kentucky, states where Republicans objectively suffered body blows, they're saying, but you know what was great? We were able to refine our message. And this was a great crucible for kind of calculating.
They're talking about refining their message.
When you're talking about message, that means you're wrong on the policy. All right. But I'm not saying both sides have reason to be to
claim
victory.
But I think in this one they clearly have.
But they do. And to the point, I think it's also correct, as several people have pointed out, that there is that migration of blue, or I don't know if it's a migration, but the core urban areas are bluer than ever, and the rural areas are certainly red. But that matters in a way, but the way that we've seen maps drawn in terms of legislative races and so forth.
You mean the gerrymandering?
The gerrymandering.
It's
masterful. And whoever is in control every 10 years when those are drawn, it's become a great science, computer-aided. It doesn't matter because those pockets of blue can be diluted to a certain extent, as we've seen time and again.
State Treasurer Daniel Elliott, Indiana's chief investment officer, recently purchased $35 million in Israeli bonds, expressing confidence in Israel's people and its economy, calling it a great opportunity for Hoosier taxpayers. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Lauren Chapman reports advocates say the purchase supports the genocide of Palestinians.
State Treasurer Daniel Elliott said in a statement, the bond purchase reflects his confidence in Israel's victory over the forces of evil. At a demonstration in Indianapolis, protesters called for the disinvestment of U.S. dollars from Israel. Malka Bird, a member of Jewish Voice for Peace Indiana, said the purchase from Indiana is unconscionable.
Any money that we give to Israel is currently supporting genocide of Palestinians. It's supporting violence and weapons that are being used against Palestinian children, against Palestinian families in Gaza.
The purchase Wednesday was the largest known by U.S. states since October 7th, according to the state treasurer's office. It oversees the investment of nearly $17 billion of state assets.
Ann Delaney, putting aside the fraught political atmosphere in this country over what's going on in Israel and Palestine, isn't this the sort of political investing decision that Daniel Elliott was ardently against when we had the ESG debate in the legislature a few months ago?
Yeah, I mean, it absolutely is. As Rex Early would say, his hypocrisy and there's hypocrisy, and that's what this is. I mean, it's either you think that it's okay to invest in issues that you think are important that also have a good return, or you don't. You can't pick and choose which ones, which is what he's trying to do. I assume that Rokita will investigate him because, you know, he's putting policy ahead of the interests of our retirees and all. And, you know, he's so opposed to that. It is just, they ought to stay out of it. They ought to make investments that make sense, that may contribute to the country and have a good return. But you can't have it both ways. And that's what he's trying to do here.
Is he trying to have it both ways on this?
I think this is why you have an ESG bill. So he is bound by law to make make an investment in the best fiduciary interest and assume he has some justification for why this is. I don't know that a good long-term investment right now is in a war-torn Middle East if you're buying government bonds. But he's the expert, not me. But I think, you know, the idea that this is an incredibly, like, complicated, nuanced issue or situation or war. And it's so ill-fit for the current political environment because there is a black-and-white component to what's happened there. Israel was attacked by terrorists on October 7th, and they're retaliating to try to eliminate Hamas with terrorist organizations. That is black and white for me. What is not black and white is how you do that, why the Western world is starting to react, including the United States, and say, hey, I think we need a timeout. We need a pause. We need to assess, you know, the collateral damage that's being done. Those are very gray, nuanced debates that we're having over here on how the war is being.
We're not set up in this country for those.
So then here comes the state of Indiana pumping out a press release that we're, you know, the state's going to invest $35 million into Israeli bonds. I don't appreciate the timing, but I'm sure the fiscal soundness of it checks.
Yeah,
it's required to by law. That's why you have it.
These are not brand new investments. We are expanding our investment in Israeli bonds. And what Elliot pointed out in his release was that historically these Israelis bonds have been a good investment. But right now, does it feel like a good... regardless of which side, if you will, you support in this issue, whether you think what Israel is doing is completely right 100%, they've never done anything wrong, or you think there is more nuance to this and that a lot of Palestinian civilians are being murdered with seemingly no thought by the Israeli government, whichever side you fall on here, is that where you'd want to put money for it to be safe?
Well, as every prospectus probably on the planet says, you know, past performance is no indication or guarantee of future return. And so you say, yes, historically they've been good, but we're dealing with situations in the Middle East that are unprecedented. So history, by definition, goes out the window. And I have not, shame on me, I did not look at the bond ratings for these bonds. But I know what happened when Fitch and others, I'm not sure which bond agency, reduced the federal government, U.S. federal government, after some of the impasse in Washington and Congress. And if you look at that, where no guns were, for the most part, pitch battle, I'm talking about among the two parties, you know, if that warrants a reduction in the rating, one would ask about this. And aside from the war and the strife, the tragedy, well, certainly nobody, there's no excuses for what was done. But it's difficult to look at a situation, even domestically, that Israel had, where there was so much internal strife over the proposed overhaul of the judiciary. There are people who said that it was closer than any time since 1948, its creation, to be a civil war. Forget Hamas. We're talking pre-Hamas internal invasion. Just the division and the strife over the Netanyahu government. Yeah. So, most people say the Netanyahu government probably won't survive because of what was leading up to this and the response. Yeah. So, again, I'm no expert. I haven't looked at the bond ratings, but it does beg the question.
Is it harder to take... Daniel Elliott was outspoken about the ESG bill throughout the legislature. We don't normally see the state treasurer's office get very involved in the legislative process. And I don't think he over-involved himself, but he was outspoken about it. And that's more than fine. But does this undercut everything he was saying months ago?
I mean, it's hard not to say a little. I remember those hearings during last session. And lots of times people testified, well, these so-called ESG investments are getting good returns, and they didn't seem to care when the discussion was, well, yes, we are investing based on these things, but we're also getting the returns. Right. It seems to me that that's exactly what he's saying, too. Yes, we're making a political statement, but we think,
checks both boxes.
Yeah. Now, I will say there was at least one credit rating agency who did come out and warn against the volatile stocks. So,
Time now for viewer feedback. Each week we post an unscientific online poll question. And this week's question is State Treasurer Daniel Elliott right to invest heavily in Israel? A, yes, or B, no. Last week's question was, will we ever see another political campaign from Mike Pence? Just 27% of you say yes, 73% say no. I'd say a Karen Pence candidacy is more likely down the line, but that's just me. I'm serious about that. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to WFYI.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, a recent report by the Herald Times in Bloomington reveals that the Monroe County Schools Corporation paid former state superintendent and current gubernatorial candidate Jennifer McCormick $144,000 over the last 3 years in no-bid contracts for consulting work. The Herald Times story says McCormick's consulting work, reportedly to support the school corporation's existing strategic plan, paid her for about 24 days a year in each of the last 3 years, to the tune of about $2,000 a day. The school district reportedly did not request bids for McCormick's work because it didn't need to under state law. The law requires at least 3 bids for contracts of at least $50,000, and each of McCormick's was for $48,000. The money came from COVID-19 relief funds.
John Schwanis, no question that Jennifer McCormick is qualified to do this sort of work, a local superintendent, the state superintendent, a teacher, a principal, et cetera. But do you see any issues with this?
I can give you 3 answers. One would be the political perspective, one would be the legal perspective, and then the educational improvement perspective. We don't have time for all of them, so I'll just say, much to your relief, I'll just say this, you know, there's nothing wrong with it, I don't think. No laws were broken, certainly, and we've seen people from both parties. Todd Rokita had a nice consulting contract during his time in office, not just as a candidate. Candidates, unless they're independently wealthy, have to fund these somewhere. Is it better that the contract be with a public entity that's committed ostensibly to improvement of our state through the education of its young people versus some fat cat Democrat that says, I think I'm going to put you on my, you know, retainer consultancy, just what's, so you can argue what's better. But there's still the optics. You know, the threshold for reporting or for bidding this was $50,000 a year, and this was at $48,000. You almost wish, couldn't you at least gone a little lot lower or a little bit higher, just so there wasn't that sort of odd, we're almost there. And I'm not saying that that thought went into it, but why, if you're a candidate for office, as she is, why leave any fodder, ammunition that can be used by your opponent?
Even if you wanted to go the no-bid route, this wasn't super public. None of this process was super public, and isn't that the problem?
Yeah, the problem I had reading the story wasn't giving her the contract. Obviously, she can do that work. But is that they couldn't show what she did. You know, first it was she was creating a strategy, a strategic plan. Then it was, no, she's working on the existing strategic plan. They couldn't provide any work product. They couldn't provide anything that they, you know, she suggested and they moved forward on. I mean, that was my issue is, you know, what did they get for the money, I think, is more my concern than the contract itself.
I mean, she is at this point, I would argue, the presumptive Democratic candidate. There is another candidate, a perennial candidate, who never has any success. So it looks like she'll be the Democratic candidate mm-hmm. for governor. Is this going to be a problem for her?
I don't think so. I mean, she's obviously qualified to do the work, and somebody's going to go back and do the research and figure out what exactly she contributed for that money, and I'm sure she did. And she's clearly qualified to do it, and, you know, it is what it is.
Democrats have such an uphill battle to climb at this point to win a statewide race. But if she is a legitimate candidate or a legitimate threat to have that sort of success, is this the sort of thing that will weigh her down at all, or is this just it's a year before next year's elections, it's a blip?
I have a conflict of interest with this topic because I think she was a Republican the first time she got paid $48,000. Then the last two,
that's
she was a Democrat.
That's a good point.
So I don't know who to attack.
What if it had been the Carmel School District? Then that's an entirely different twist rather than Bloomington.
That's funny. All right. Speaking of this week's elections, Ohioans voted to legalize cannabis for those aged 21 or older. Meanwhile, back in Indiana, a legislative study committee made no recommendations following nearly 7 hours of discussion on the legalization of adult-use cannabis. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Abigail Ruman reports lawmakers were tasked with discussing how cannabis use would relate to workforce issues and teen use.
Committee members heard from researchers, community leaders, and lawyers on whether or not Indiana should consider legislation to legalize cannabis. Senator Scott Baldwin is the chair of the Interim Study Committee on Commerce and Economic Development. He says it will not offer any recommendations related to cannabis.
We have a lot of competing opinions in this room. If we want to be here till midnight, I don't think we'll gain consensus. And so as the chair, I'm saying we're not going to recommend anything associated with that last topic.
The vice chair asked Baldwin to consider a recommendation on regulating hemp or CBD products that are already legal in the state. Baldwin says he would rather not have any recommendations on hemp or cannabis. When it came time to vote on a final report that included recommendations on other issues, two members objected to the lack of recommendations on cannabis. Both voted no, and the report failed by one vote.
Nikki Kelly, the question I wrote here was, does Ohio's election result matter to Indiana? Obviously, it matters to folks who live close to Ohio and will now be able to go across the border. But in terms of, you know, I saw all these stories talking about the pressure this puts on Indiana. There was already lots of pressure.
Well, but it's been building. My fear is that we're at the tipping point where now even the people who might have been open to it are now going to be like, nope, I'm not giving into this. Like, you know, almost put up a wall saying we're not going to be pressed into this just because a bunch of other states did. No. And yeah. So I wonder if it's going to actually hurt it a little.
They're not going to be pressed into asking the voters what the voters want on this issue and on choice. I mean, why don't they have a non-binding referendum? Are they afraid? I think they are, of what the voters would say because they're not in touch with them. But the idea that democracy works is that you're doing the will of the people who put you there. And they ought to at least ask that question.
We haven't had a non-binding since what, gaming?
Well, it's been a long time, but it's clearly now.
There is precedent for it.
Yes.
But, you know, we, as Republicans, were quick to point out.
Even the precedent is led by the legislature. It's not led by citizens.
No, it's not led by citizens.
That's the problem. Otherwise, it would be on the ballot. The
Indiana Republican Party made very clear in its platform that we are not a democracy. We are a democratic republic. We are a republic.
Yeah,
and so
okay.
Their argument is the referendum is every 2 years there are state house elections.
In the gerrymandered districts.
And so does this put any extra pressure at this point on Indiana?
There will be that argument that, if they're just hurting our illicit cannabis dealers. Now we can't compete fairly with the legal cannabis dealers across,
economic development issue?
Some people will make it as such. I mean, the dollars are going out of state, guarantee. We've heard that in the past, those arguments.
We've known that. I mean, Michigan and we
know
that. Shown that.
Let's remember that the current governor, last time I checked, his term is not up, has already said it's a no-go in his mind, not philosophically necessarily. He's not for weed, against weed. It's just it's against federal law and in terms of the
majority of the states are going to have it legalized now.
Well, we're going to be following.
It's more than a majority. Coming in overwhelming.
Not all recreational though.
The charge of this commission, the charge of this committee this year, this interim, was to explore and identify the problems with legalization. What does it do to the illicit market? What does it do to underage use? What does it do to workforce issues? What's the impact on police? I hear what you're saying, that you put this on the ballot at 70% yes in Indiana, right? That is true, but the way this issue has always been talked about is like, oh, no, we should definitely do that. There's a lot of money a lot of states are doing, and that's about the beginning, middle, and end of people's sophistication on thinking it through. So I do think that because we have leadership here, including the governor, that have said, look, we're not for this yet. It's still legal at the federal level. They haven't rescheduled it, which the Biden administration is doing. And Indiana's probably what's likely to happen is we miss the boat. They legalize it to some degree at the federal level or allow interstate, you know, and then we just don't have the opportunity to grow the industry.
Well, so that creates an issue of if the feds do, I mean, boy, talked about the federal government's getting to something first. It doesn't happen often. But if the federal government does get to this first before Indiana ultimately does anything really, because other states even put in like the sort of like framework similar to what we did with the online sales tax.
Yeah, like a trigger law.
It hadn't happened yet, but we were prepared for it, and we were able to get ahead of a lot of states.
And we won't be.
Well, does that even create a potential for some chaos in Indiana?
Well, if it does get descheduled by the federal government, it can be mailed. Yeah. It can be delivered by your UPS carrier. We will be left behind.
Well, that was an argument the state advocates of gaming expansion to digital gaming, online gaming used.
Yeah.
So it's interesting how you can use the argument
You brought up Eric Holcomb. I saw a story in South Bend talking to Jake Teschka, who actually brought legislation on decriminalization or on legalization last year, talking about he thinks it'll wait for the next governor. I didn't remember a time when Indiana House Republicans or Senate Republicans cared what Eric Holcomb thought on an issue before
on anything.
Passing it.
This is not
but
an emergency,
apparently this
so
is
maybe.
The one.
Yeah.
All right, finally, Jay Kenworthy, who works for Senator Todd Young, posted online that a man came into a church that his mother works at this week looking to vote. Now, the church regularly serves as a polling place, and the man wanted to cast his ballot for governor. Even after Jay's mother said that that race wasn't until next year, the man insisted the election must be this year because he'd already been seeing all the ads on TV. Mike O'Brien, could this man be forgiven for thinking Indiana was electing a new governor this year?
It's even worse than you think. There was the guy that was against Jefferson Shreve because he couldn't vote for that guy that was accused of assaulting 37 women, which was Donald Trump that was put in the Hogsett ad against Shreve.
Well,
so it's
he
just
was
like
a Trump supporter.
Well, the obvious.
But, you know, the thing about this that's so crazy, the fees for these ads go up again now that the election's over. Thank God, is all I've got to say. Because you can't watch
anything
without having.
Well, look, I don't think it's going to stop.
This was the most expensive municipal election we've ever had. We are going into not even close being the most expensive Republican governor's.
The unanswered question here is who is he going to vote for? I mean, who is he supporting?
True. I don't know who he's supporting.
At this point, a one-person focus group is pretty valuable. A lot cheaper than a poll.
That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Anne Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Indiana Capital Chronicle. You can find Indiana Week in Review's podcast and episodes at wfyi.org/IWIR or on the PBS app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana's public broadcasting stations.